There was an extra panel. There were tiny hinges so high up, a knee would never brush them, so the door would swing upward when it was open. How to open it was the mystery. After I'd had a good look, Donald said,
"I'll try my pocket knife, Miss Stackhouse, if you have no objection."
"None at all," I said. He retrieved the pocket knife, which was a businesslike size, from his pocket and opened the blade, sliding it gently into the seam. As I'd expected, in the middle of the seam, he encountered a clasp of some kind. He pushed gently with the knife blade, first from one side and then another, but nothing happened. Next, he began patting around the woodwork all around the knee hole. There was a strip of wood at both points where the sides and top of the knee hole met. Donald pressed and pushed, and just when I was about to throw up my hands, there was a rusty click, and the panel opened.
"Why don't you do the honors?" Donald said. "Your desk."
That was both reasonable and true, and as he backed out, I took his place. I lifted the door and held it up while Donald held his flashlight steady, but since my body blocked a lot of the light, I had quite a time extracting the contents. I gently gripped and pulled when I felt the contours of the bundle, and then I had it. I wriggled backwards on my haunches, trying not to imagine what that must look like from Donald's viewpoint. As soon as I was clear of the desk, I rose and went over to the window with my dusty bundle. I examined what I held. There was a small velvet bag with a drawstring top. The material had been wine red, I believed, once upon a time. There was a once white envelope, about 6x8, with pictures on it, and as I carefully flattened it, I realized it had held a dress pattern. Immediately, a flood of memory came undammed. I remembered the box that had held all the patterns, Vogue and Simplicity and Butterick. My grandmother had enjoyed sewing for many years until a broken finger in her right hand hadn't set well, and then it had become more and more painful for her to manage the tissue-thin patterns and the materials. From the picture, this particular envelope had held a pattern that was full-skirted and nipped in at the waist, and the three drawn models had fashionably hunched shoulders, thin faces, and short hair. One model was wearing the dress as mid-length, one was wearing it as a wedding dress, and one was wearing it as a square dance costume, the versatile full-skirted dress. I opened the flap and peered in, expecting to see the familiar brown, flimsy pattern paper printed with mysterious black directions. But instead, there was a letter inside, written on yellowed paper. I recognized the handwriting. Suddenly, I was as close to tears as I could be. I held my eyes wide so the liquid wouldn't trickle, and I left the living room very quickly. It wasn't possible to open that envelope with other people in the house, so I stowed it in my bedside table along with a little bag, and I returned to the living room after I'd blotted my eyes. The two antiques dealers were too courteous to ask questions, and I brewed some coffee and brought it to them on a tray with some milk and sugar and some slices of pound cake, because I was grateful and polite, as my grandmother had taught me, my dead grandmother, whose handwriting had been on the letter inside the pattern envelope. Chapter 5. In the end, I didn't get to open the envelope until the next day. Brenda and Donald finished going over all the attic contents an hour after he'd opened the hidden drawer. Then we sat down to discuss what they wanted from my miscellaneous clutter and how much they'd pay me for it. At first, I was minded to simply say, "Okay," but in the name of my family, I felt obliged to try to get as much money as possible. To my impatience, the discussion went on for what seemed like forever. What it boiled down to: they wanted 4 large pieces of furniture, including the desk, a couple of dress forms, a small chest, some spoons, and 2 horn snuff boxes. Some of the underwear was in good shape, and Brenda said she knew a method of washing that would remove stains and make the garments look almost new, though she wouldn't give me much for them. A nursing chair, too low and small for modern women, was added to the list, and Donald wanted a box of costume jewelry from the 30s and 40s. My great-grandmother's quilt, made in the wagon wheel pattern, was obviously worth a lot to the dealers, and that had never been my favorite pattern, so I was glad to let it go. I was actually pleased that these items would be going to homes where they'd be enjoyed and cared for and cherished instead of being stowed in an attic. I could tell that Donald really wanted to go through the big box of pictures and papers still awaiting my attention, but there was no way that was going to happen until I'd looked at all of them. I told him so in very polite terms, and we also shook on the agreement that if any more secret compartments of any kind were found in the furniture I was selling them, I would have first right to buy the contents back if the contents had any money value. After they'd called their store to arrange pickup and written a check, the dealers departed with one or two of their smaller purchases. They seemed as satisfied as I was with the day's work. Within an hour, a big, splendid truck came up the driveway with two husky young men in the cab. 45 minutes after that, the furniture was padded and loaded into the back. After it was gone, it was time for me to get ready for work. I regretfully postponed examining the items in my night table drawer. Though I had to hustle, I took a moment to enjoy having my house to myself as I put on my makeup and my uniform. It was warm enough to break out my shorts, I decided. I'd gone to Walmart and bought two new pair the week before. In honor of their debut, I'd made sure my legs were shaved extra smooth. My tan was already well established. I looked in the mirror, pleased with the look. I got to Merlot's about 5. The first person I saw was the new waitress, India. India had smooth, chocolate skin and cornrows and a stud in her nose, and she was the most cheerful human being I'd encountered in a month of Sundays. Today, she gave me a smile as if I were exactly the person she'd been waiting to see, which was literally true. I was replacing India.
"You look out for trouble with that goober on 5, she said. "He's tossing him back. He must have had a fight with his wife."
I would know if he had or not after a moment's listening in.
"Thanks, India. Anything else?" "That couple on 11? They want their tea unsweet with lots of lemon on the side. Their food should be up soon. The fried pickles and a burger each. Cheese on his."
"Okie dokie. Have a good evening."
"I'm planning on it. I got a date."
"Who with?" I asked out of sheer idle curiosity.
"Lola Rushton," she said.
"I think I went to high school with Lola," I said, with only a short beat to indicate that India's dating women was any more than a daily occurrence.
"She remembers you,"
India said, and laughed. I was sure that was so, since I'd been the weirdest person in my little high school class. "Everyone remembers me as Crazy Sookie," I said, trying to keep the rue from my voice.
"She had a crush on you for a while,"
India told me. I felt oddly pleased.
"I'm flattered to hear it,"
I said, and hustled off to start working. I made a quick round of my tables to be sure everyone was okay, served the fried pickles and burgers, and watched in relief as Mr. Grumpy and Dumped downed his last drink and left the bar. He wasn't drunk, but he was spoiling for a fight, and it was good to see the last of him. We didn't need more trouble. He wasn't the only grumpy guy in Merlot's. Sam was filling out insurance forms that night, and because he hates filling out forms but has to do it all the time, his mood was not sunny. The paperwork was stacked on the bar, and in a lull between customers, I looked it over. If I read it carefully and slowly, it wasn't hard to figure out, no matter how convoluted the English got. I began checking boxes and filling in blanks, and I called the police station and told them we needed a copy of the police report on the firebombing. I gave them Sam's fax number, and Kevin promised he'd get it to me. I looked up to find my boss standing there with an expression of total surprise on his face.
"I'm sorry," I said instantly. "You seem to be so stressed out about it, and I didn't mind taking a look. I'll hand them back over."
I grabbed up the papers and thrust them at Sam. "No," he said, backing away with his hands held up.
"No, no. Sook, thanks. I never thought of asking for help."
He glanced down.
"You called the police station?"
"Yeah, I got Kevin Pryor. He's gonna send over the report to attach."
"Thanks, Sook."
Sam looked like Santa Claus had just appeared in the bar.
"I don't mind forms," I said, smiling. "They don't talk back. You better look it over to make sure I did it right."
Sam beamed at me without sparing a downward glance.
Good job, friend.
No problem. It had been nice to have something to keep me busy so I wouldn't think about the unexamined items in my night table drawer. I heard the front door open and looked around, relieved there was more business walking in the door. I had to work to hold the anticipation on my face when I saw that Janel and Hopper had arrived. Sam is what you might call adventuresome in his dating, and Janelin was not the first strong, not to say scary, female he consorted with. Skinny and short, Janelin had an aggressive sense of fashion and a ferocious delight in her elevation to the job of pack enforcer for the Longtooth Pack, which was based in Shreveport. Tonight, Janelin was wearing abbreviated denim shorts, those sandals that lace up the calves, and a single blue tank top with no bra underneath. She was wearing the earrings Sam had bought her at Splendide, and about 6 silver chains of assorted lengths and pendants gleamed around her neck. Her short hair was platinum now, spiky and bright. She was like a sun catcher, I thought, remembering the brightly colored one Jason had given me to hang in the kitchen window.
Hello, honey, she said to Sam as she bypassed me without a sideways glance.
She took Sam in a ferocious embrace and kissed him for all she was worth. He kissed her back, though I could tell from his brain signals that he was a little embarrassed. No such consideration bothered Janelin, of course. I hastily turned away to check the levels of salt and pepper in the shakers on the table, though I knew quite well everything was fine. In truth, I'd always found Janelin disturbing, almost frightening. She was very aware that Sam and I were friends, especially since I'd met Sam's family at his brother's wedding, and they were under the impression that I was Sam's girlfriend. I really didn't blame her for her suspicions. If I'd been her, I'd have felt the same way. Janelin was a suspicious young woman by both nature and profession. Part of her job was to assess threats and act on them before harm could come to Alcide and the pack. She also managed Hair of the Dog, a little bar that catered especially to the Longtooth Pack and other Tuies in the Shreveport area. It was a lot of responsibility for someone as young as Janelin, but she seemed born to meet the challenge. By the time I'd exhausted all the busy work I could think of, Janelin and Sam were having a quiet conversation. She was perched on a bar stool, her muscular legs crossed elegantly, and he was in his usual position behind the bar. Her face was intent, and so was his. Whatever their topic was, it was a serious one. I kept my mind slammed shut. The customers were doing their best not to gape at the young ware. The other waitress, Danielle, was glancing over at her from time to time while whispering with her boyfriend, who'd come in to nurse a drink all evening so he could watch Danielle as she moved from table to table. Whatever Janelin's faults, you couldn't deny that she had real presence. When she was in a room, she had to be acknowledged. I thought that was at least partially because she gave off such strong vibes that she was scary as hell. A couple came in and glanced around before heading to an empty table in my section. They looked a little familiar. After a moment, I recognized them, Jack and Lily Leeds, private detectives from somewhere in Arkansas. The last time I'd seen them, they'd come to Bon Ton to investigate Debbie Pelt's disappearance, having been hired by her parents. I'd answered their questions in what I now knew was sort of fairy style. I'd stuck to the letter of the truth without its spirit. I myself had shot Debbie Pelt dead in self-defense, and I hadn't wanted to go to jail for it. That had been over a year ago. Lily Bard Leeds was still pale, silent, and intense, and her husband was still attractive and vital. Her eyes had found me instantly, and it was impossible to pretend I hadn't noticed. Reluctantly, I went over to their table, feeling my smile growing more brittle with every step.
"Welcome back to Merlot's," I said, grinning for all I was worth. "What can I get you to this evening? We put French fried pickles on the menu, and our burgers Lafayette are real good."
Lily looked as if I'd suggested she eat breaded worms, though Jack looked a bit regretful. He wouldn't have minded the pickles, I could tell.
"A hamburger Lafayette for me, I guess,"
Lily said unenthusiastically. As she turned to her companion, her t-shirt shifted, and I caught a glimpse of a set of old scars that rivaled my own new ones.
Well, we had always had things in common.
The hamburger for me too, Jack said. And if you have a moment to spare, we'd like to talk to you.
He smiled at me, and the long, thin scar on his face flexed as his eyebrows rose.
Was this personal mutilation evening? I wondered if his light jacket, unnecessary on so warm a day, covered something even worse.
We can have a talk. I figured you didn't come back to Merlot's because of the great cuisine, I said, and took their drink order before I went over to the window to hand the slip to Antoine. With their iced teas and a dish of lemon, I returned to the table. I looked around to make sure no one needed me before I sat down opposite Jack with Lily to my left. She was pretty to look at, but so controlled and muscular, I felt like I could bounce a dime off her. Even her mind was sort of tidy and strict.
What shall we talk about?
I asked, and opened up my mind to them. Jack was thinking about Lily, some concern about her health, no, her mother's health, a recurrence of breast cancer. Lily was thinking about me, puzzling over me, suspecting I was a killer. That hurt, but it was true.
Sandra Pelt is out of jail, Jack Leeds said, and though I heard the words in his brain before he spoke them, I didn't have to fake a shocked face.
She was in jail? So that's why I haven't seen her since her folks died?
The older Pelts had promised to keep Sandra in check. After I'd heard about their deaths, I'd wondered when she'd show up. When I hadn't seen her right away, I'd relaxed.
You're telling me this because,
I managed to say.
Because she hates your guts, Lily said calmly. And you were never found guilty by any court of the disappearance of her sister. You weren't even arrested. I don't think you ever will be. You might even be innocent, though I don't think so.
Sandra Pelt is simply crazy, and she's obsessed with you. I think you need to be careful, real careful.
Why was she in jail?
Assault and battery on one of her cousins. This cousin had gotten a cut of the money in Sandra's parents' will, and apparently Sandra took issue with that.
I was very, very worried.
Sandra Pelt was a vicious and amoral young woman. I was sure she hadn't hit 20 yet, and she'd made a determined attempt to kill me more than once. There was no one now to call her to heel, and her mental status was therefore even more suspect, according to the private detectives.
But why did you make a trip down here to tell me? I said. I mean, I do appreciate it, but you weren't obliged, and you could have picked up the phone. Private eyes work for money, last I heard. Is someone paying you to warn me?
The Pelt estate, Lily said after a pause. Their lawyer, who lives in New Orleans, is the court-appointed guardian for Sandra until she reaches 21.
His name?
She pulled a piece of paper out of her pocket. It's a sort of Baltic name, she said, and I may not pronounce it correctly.
Cataliades,
I said, putting the emphasis on the second syllable where it belonged. Yes, said Jack, surprised. That's him, big guy.
I nodded. Mr. Cataliades and I were friendly. He was mostly a demon, but the Leedses didn't seem to know that. In fact, they didn't seem to know much of anything about the other world, the one that lay beneath the human one.
So Mr. Cataliades sent you two down here to warn me? He's the executor?
Yeah, he was going to be away from his desk for some time, and he wanted to be sure you knew the girl was on the loose. He seemed to feel some obligation to you.
I pondered that. I only knew of one time I'd done the lawyer a good turn. I'd helped him get out of the collapsing hotel in Rhodes. Nice to know that at least one person was serious when he said, I owe you. It seemed pretty ironic that the Pelt estate was paying the Leedses to come warn me against the last living Pelt. Not ironic as in ha, but ironic as in bitter.
If you don't mind me asking, how come he contacted you two? I mean, I'm sure there are lots of private eyes in New Orleans, for example. You all are still based in the Little Rock area, right?
Lily shrugged. He called us. He asked if we were free. He sent the check. His instructions were very specific. Both of us, to the bar, today. In fact, she glanced down at her watch, to the minute. They looked at me expectantly,
waiting for me to explain this oddity on the part of the lawyer. I was thinking furiously. If Mr. Cataliades had sent two tough people to the bar, instructing them to arrive at a given time, it must be because he knew they were going to be needed. For some reason, their presence was necessary and desirable. When would you need capable hard bodies? When trouble was on its way. Before I knew I was going to do it, I stood and turned toward the entrance. Naturally, the Leedses looked where I was looking, so we were all watching the door when trouble opened it. Four tough guys came in. My grandmother would have said they were loaded for bear. They might as well have stenciled badass and proud of it on their foreheads. They were definitely high on something, full of themselves, brimming with aggression, and armed. After a second's peek in their heads, I knew they'd taken vampire blood. That was the most unpredictable drug on the market, also the most expensive, because harvesting it was so dangerous. People who drank vampire blood were, for a length of time impossible to predict, incredibly strong and incredibly reckless, and sometimes batshit crazy. Though her back was to the newcomers, Janilyn seemed to smell them. She swung around on her stool and focused, just like someone had drawn a bow and aimed the arrow. I could feel the animal wafting off her. Something wild and savage filled the air, and I realized the smell was coming from Sam, too. Jack and Lily Leeds were on their feet. Jack had his hand under his jacket, and I knew he had a gun. Lily's hands were poised in a strange way, as if she were about to gesture and had frozen in mid-move.
"Howdy ho, jerk-offs,"
said the tallest one, addressing the bar in general. He had a heavy beard and thick, dark hair, but underneath I saw how young he was. I thought he couldn't be more than 19.
"We come to have fun with you lizards."
"No lizards here," Sam said, his voice even and calm. "You fellers are welcome to have a drink, but after that, I think you better leave. This is a quiet place, a local place, and we don't need trouble."
"Trouble's already here,"
boasted the shortest asshole. His face was clean-shaven, and his hair was only blonde stubble, showing scars on his scalp. He was built broad and chunky. The third kid was thin and dark, maybe Hispanic. His black hair was slicked back, and his lips had a sensuous pout to them that he tried to counteract by sneering. The fourth guy had gotten off on the vampire blood even more seriously than the rest, and he couldn't speak because he was lost in his own world. His eyes jerked from side to side as if he were tracking things the rest of us couldn't see. He was big, too. I thought the first attack would come from him, and though I was the least of the combatants, I began to ease to my right, planning to come at him from the side.
"We can have peace here," Sam said. He was still trying, though I knew he understood that there was no way we were going to escape violence.
He was buying time for everyone in Merlot's to understand what was up. That was a good idea. By the time a few more seconds had passed, even the slowest of the few patrons had moved as far from the action as they could get, except for Danny Prideaux, who'd been playing darts with Andy Belfleur, and Andy himself. Danny was actually holding a dart. Andy was off duty, but he was armed. I watched Jack Leeds' eyes and saw he'd realized, as I had, where the worst trouble would come from. The dazed hoodlum was actually rocking back and forth on his heels. Since Jack Leeds had a gun and I did not, I carefully inched backward so I wouldn't interfere with his shot. Lily's cold eyes followed my small movement, and she nodded almost undetectably. I'd done a sensible thing.
"We don't want peace," snarled bearded leader. "We want the blonde."
And he pointed in my direction with his left hand, while his right hand pulled a knife. It looked like it was 2 feet long, though maybe my fear was acting like a magnifying glass.
"We gonna take care of her,"
Blonde Bristles said.
"And then maybe the rest of you,"
Pouty Lips added. Crazy Guy just smiled.
"I don't think so," Jack Leeds said.
Jack pulled his gun in one smooth movement. Possibly he would have done it anyway out of sheer self-defense, but it didn't hurt that his wife, standing right by me, was blonde. He couldn't be completely sure they meant me, the other white meat.
"I don't think so either," said Andy Belfleur.
His arm was rock steady as he aimed his own Sig Sauer at the man with the knife.
You drop that pig sticker and we'll work something out.
They might be high as kites, but at least three of the thugs retained enough sense to realize that facing guns was a bad idea. There was a lot of uncertain twitching and eye shifting as they flickered gazes at each other. The moment hung in the balance. Unfortunately, Crazy Guy went over the edge and charged for Sam, so now we were all committed to stupidity. With rare swiftness, Pouty Lips whipped out his own gun, aimed, and fired. I'm not sure who he intended to hit, but he winged Jack Leeds, whose return shot went wild as he fell. Watching Lily Leeds was a lesson in motion. She took two quick steps, pivoted on her left foot, and her right foot floated through the air to kick Pouty Lips in the head with the force of a mule. Almost before he hit the floor, she was on him, pitching his gun toward the bar and breaking his arm in a flow of motion that was nearly hypnotic. As he screamed, Bearded Asshole and Blonde Bristles gaped at her. That second of inattention was all it took. Janilyn took a flying leap off her bar stool, describing an amazing arc through the air. She landed on Crazy Guy as Sam tackled him, and though CG howled and snapped and tried to throw her off, Janilyn reared back to punch him in the jaw. I distinctly heard the bone break, and then Janilyn leaped to her feet and stomped on his femur. Another snap. Sam, still holding him down, yelled, "Stop!" In those seconds, Andy Belfleur rushed Bearded Asshole, who'd whirled to present his back to Andy when Lily attacked Pouty Lips. When the tall guy felt the gun in his back, he froze.
"Drop the knife," Andy said.
He was in deadly earnest. Blonde Bristles cocked his arm back to strike a blow. Danny Prideaux threw his dart. It got Blonde Bristles square in the meat of his arm, and he shrieked like a tea kettle. Sam abandoned Crazy Guy to punch Blonde Bristles right in his brisket. The guy went down like a sawn tree. Bearded Asshole looked at his buddies, down and disabled, and then he dropped the knife. Sensible. Finally. In less than 2 minutes, it was all over. I'd whipped my clean white apron off, and I bound Jack Leeds's wound while Lily held his arm out for me, her face white as a vampire's. She wanted to kill Pouty Lips in the worst possible way because she loved her husband with an overwhelming passion. The strength of her feelings almost swamped me. Lily might be icy on the outside, but inside she was Vesuvius. As soon as Jack's bleeding slowed, she turned to Pouty Lips, her face still absolutely calm. "You even move, I'll break your fucking neck," she said, her voice uninflected. The young thug probably didn't even hear her through his own groaning and moaning, but her tone came through, and he tried to inch away from her. Andy had already talked to the 911 dispatcher. In a moment, I heard the siren, a disturbingly familiar sound. We might as well retain an ambulance to stay in the parking lot at this rate. Crazy Guy was screaming weakly at the pain in his leg and jaw. Sam had saved his life. Janilyn was actually panting, she was so close to changing, after the excitement and stimulation of the violence. The bones had slid around underneath the skin of her face, which was looking long and lumpy. It wouldn't be good if she became a wolf before law enforcement got here. I didn't try to spell out why to myself. I said, "Hey, Janilyn." Her eyes met mine. Hers were changing shape and color. Her little figure began to twist and turn restlessly. "You have to stop," I said. All around us there was yelling and excitement and the thick atmosphere of fear, not a good atmosphere for a young werewolf. "You can't change now." I kept my eyes fixed on hers. I didn't speak again, but made sure she kept looking at me. "Breathe with me," I said, and she made the effort. Gradually, her own breathing slowed, and even more gradually, her face resumed its normal contours. Her body ceased its restless movement, and her eyes returned to their regular brown. "All right," she said. Sam put his hands on her thin shoulders. He gave her a tight hug. "Thanks, honey," he said. "Thanks. You're the greatest." I felt the faintest thrum of exasperation.
"Left your ass in the dust," she said, and laughed raggedly.
Was that a good jump or what? Wait till I tell Alcide.
You're the quickest, Sam said, his voice gentle. You're the best pack enforcer I ever met.
You would have thought he'd told her she was as sexy as Heidi Klum, she was so proud. And then the law enforcement people and the emergency people were there, and we had to go through the whole procedure again. Lily and Jack Leeds took off to the hospital. She told the ambulance personnel she could take him herself in their car, and I understood from her thoughts that their insurance wouldn't cover the whole cost of the ambulance ride. Considering the emergency room was only a few blocks away, and Jack was walking and talking, I could see her reasoning. They never did get their food, and I didn't get to thank them for the warning and for their promptness in obeying Mr. Cataliades' orders. I wondered more than ever how he'd managed to shunt them into the bar in such a timely manner. Andy was pardonably proud of his part in the incident, and he got some pats on the back from his fellow officers. They all regarded Janilyn with barely concealed mistrust and respect. All the bar patrons who tried to stay out of the way were falling all over themselves to describe Lily Leeds' great kick and Janilyn's show-stopping leap onto Crazy Guy. Somehow, the picture the police got was that these four strangers had announced their intention to take Lily hostage and then to rob Merlot's. I'm not sure how that impression gathered credibility, but I was glad it did. If the bar patrons assumed that the blonde in question had been Lily Leeds, that was fine with me. She was certainly an outstanding-looking woman, and the strangers might have been following her, or they might have decided to rob the bar and take Lily as a bonus. Due to this welcome misconception, I escaped from any more questioning that the other patrons got. In the grand scheme of things, I thought it was about time I got a break. Chapter 6. Sunday morning, I woke up worried. I'd been too sleepy the night before when I finally got home to think much about what had happened at the bar. But evidently my subconscious had been chewing it over while I slept. My eyes flew open, and though the room was quiet and sunny, I gasped. I had that panicky feeling. It hadn't taken me over yet, but it was just around the corner, physically and mentally. You know the feeling? When you think any second your heart's gonna start pounding, that your breathing is picking up, and that your palms will start sweating? Sandra Pelt was after me, and I didn't know where she was or what she was plotting. Victor had it in for Eric, and by extension, me. I was sure I was the blonde the four thugs had been after, and I didn't know who'd sent them or what they would have done when they got me, though I had a pretty bad feeling about that. Eric and Pam were on the outs, and I was sure that somehow I was involved in their dispute. And I had a list of questions. At the top of the list, how had Mr. Cataliades known that I would need help at that particular time in that particular place? And how had he known to send the private investigators from Little Rock? Of course, if he had been the Pelt's lawyer, he might have known that they'd sent Lily and Jack Leeds to investigate their daughter Debbie's disappearance. He wouldn't have had to brief the Leeds as much, and he would have known they could handle themselves in a fight. Would the four thugs tell the police why they'd come to the bar and who'd put them up to it? And where they'd gotten the vampire blood? That would be helpful knowledge also. What would the things I'd gotten from the secret drawer tell me about my past? This is a fine kettle of fish, I said out loud. I pulled the sheet over my head and searched the house mentally. No one was here but me. Maybe Dermot and Claude were all talked out after their big reveal. They seemed to have stayed in Monroe. Sighing, I sat up in bed, letting the sheet fall away. There was no hiding from my problems. The best I could do was try to prioritize my crises and figure out what information I could gather about each one. The most important problem was the one closest to my heart, and its solution was right to hand. I gently extracted the pattern envelope and the worn velvet bag from the drawer of the bedside table. In addition to the practical contents, a flashlight, a candle, and matches, the drawer held the strange mementos of my strange life.
but I wasn't interested in anything today but the two new precious items. I carried them into the kitchen and laid them carefully back on the counter, well away from the sink, as I made my coffee. While the coffee pot dripped, I almost pushed back the flap of the pattern envelope, but I pulled back my hand. I was scared. Instead, I tracked down my address book. I charged my cell phone overnight, so I stowed the little cord away neatly, any delay would do, and at last, taking a deep breath, I punched in Mr. Cataliades' number. It rang three times.
"This is Desmond Cataliades,"
his rich voice said.
"I'm traveling and unavailable at the moment, but if you'd like to leave a message, I may call you back. Or not."
Well, hell. I made a face at the telephone, but at the sound of the tone, I dutifully recorded a guarded message that I hoped would convey my urgent need to talk to the lawyer. I crossed Mr. Cataliades, Desmond, off my mental list and moved on to my second method of approach to the problem of Sandra Pelt. Sandra was going to keep after me until either I was dead or she was. I had a real, true, personal enemy. It was hard to believe that every member of a family had turned out so rotten, especially since both Debbie and Sandra were adopted. But all the Pelts were selfish, strong-willed, and hateful. The girls were fruits of the poisonous tree, I guess. I needed to know where Sandra was, and I knew someone who might be able to help me.
"Hello?"
Amelia said briskly.
"How's life in the Big Easy?" I asked.
"Sookie! Gosh, it's good to hear your voice. Things are going great for me, actually.
Do tell."
"Bob showed up on my doorstep last week," she said.
After Amelia's mentor, Octavia, had turned Bob back into his skinny, Mormonish self, Bob had been so angry with Amelia that he'd taken off like, well, like a scalded cat. As soon as he'd reoriented to being human, Bob had left Bon Ton to track down his family, who'd been in New Orleans during Katrina. Evidently, Bob had calmed down about the whole transformation into a cat issue.
"Did he find his folks?"
"Well, he did. His aunt and his uncle, the ones who raised him. They had gotten an apartment in Natchez just big enough for the two of them, and he could tell they didn't have any way to add him to the household, so he traveled around a bit checking on other coven members, and then he wandered back down here. He's got a job cutting hair in a shop 3 blocks away from where I work. He came in the magic shop, asked after me."
Members of Amelia's coven ran the genuine magic shop in the French Quarter.
"I was surprised to see him, but real happy."
She was practically purring on the last sentence, and I figured Bob had entered the room.
"He says, hey, Sookie."
"Hey, back at him."
"Listen, Amelia, I hate to interfere in love's young dream, but I got a favor to ask."
"Shoot."
"I need to find out where someone is."
"Telephone book?"
"Ha ha, not that simple. Sandra Pelt is out of jail and gunning for me, literally. The bar's been firebombed, and yesterday 4 drugged-up goons came in to get me, and I think Sandra might be behind both things. I mean, how many enemies can I have?"
I heard Amelia take a long breath.
"Don't answer that," I said hastily. "So, she's failed twice, and I'm afraid that soon she'll pick up the pace and send someone here to the house. I'll be alone, and it won't end good for me."
"Why didn't she start there?"
I finally figured out I should have asked myself that a few days ago. "Do you think your wards are still active?"
"Oh, sure. They very well could be."
Amelia sounded just a shade pleased. She was very proud of her witchy abilities, as well she ought to be.
"Really? I mean, think about it. You haven't been here in, gosh, almost 3 months.
Amelia had packed up her car the first week in March.
"True, but I reinforced them before I left."
"They work even when you aren't around?"
I wanted to be sure. My life depended on it.
"They will for a while. After all, I was out of the house for hours each day and left it guarded. But I do have to renew them, or they'll fade. You know, I got 3 days in a row I don't have to work. I think I'll come up there and check out the situation."
That would be a huge relief, though I hate to put you out.
Nah, no problem. Maybe me and Bob will have a road trip. I'll ask a couple of other coven members how they find people. We can take care of the wards and give finding the bitch a shot.
You think Bob will be willing to come back here?
Bob had spent almost his whole sojourn in my house in feline form, so I was doubtful.
I can only ask him. Unless you hear from me, I'm coming.
Thanks so much. I hadn't realized my muscles were so tense until they began to relax. Amelia said she was coming. I wondered why I didn't feel safer with my two fairy guys around. They were my kin, and though I felt happy and relaxed when they were in the house, I trusted Amelia more. On the practical side, I never knew when Claude and Dermot would actually be under my roof. They were spending more and more nights in Monroe. I'd have to put Amelia and Bob in the bedroom across the hall from mine, since the guys were occupying the upstairs. The bed in my old room was narrow, but neither Bob nor Amelia were large people. This was all just make work for my head. I poured a mug of coffee and picked up the envelope and the bag. I sat down at the kitchen table with the objects in front of me. I had a terrible impulse to open the garbage can and drop them both in it, unopened, the knowledge in them unlearned. But that was not something you did. You opened things that were meant to be opened. I opened the flap and tipped the envelope. The flouncy-skirted bride in the picture stared at me blandly as a yellowed letter slid out. It felt dusty somehow, as though its years in the attic had soaked into the microscopic crevices in the paper. I sighed and closed my eyes, bracing myself. Then I unfolded the paper and looked down at my grandmother's handwriting. It was unexpectedly painful to see it, spiky and compressed, poorly spelled and punctuated, but it was hers, my grand's. I had read God knows how many things she'd written in our life together, grocery lists, instructions, recipes, even a few personal notes. There was a bundle of them in my dressing table still.
Sookie, I'm so proud of you for graduating from high school. I wish your mom and dad had been here to see you in your cap and gown. Sookie, please pick up your room. I can't vacuum if I can't see the floor. Sookie, Jason will pick you up after softball practice. I have to go to a meeting of the garden club.
I was sure this letter would be different. I was right. She began formally.
Dear Sookie, I think you'll find this, if anyone does. There's nowhere else I can leave it, and when I think you're ready, I'll tell you where I put it.
Tears welled up in my eyes. She'd been murdered before she thought I was ready. Maybe I never would have been ready.
You know I loved your grandfather more than anything.
I'd thought I'd known that. They'd had a rock-solid marriage, I'd assumed. The evidence suggested that might not have been the case.
But I did want children so bad, so bad. I felt if I had children, my life would be perfect. I didn't realize asking God for a perfect life was a stupid thing to do. I got tempted beyond my ability to resist. God was punishing me for my greed, I guess. He was so beautiful. But I knew when I saw him that he wasn't a real person. He told me later he was part human, but I never saw much humanity in him. Your grandfather had left for Baton Rouge, a long trip then. Later that morning, we'd had a storm that knocked down a big pine by the driveway, so it was blocked. I was trying to saw up the pine so your grandfather would be able to bring the truck back up the driveway. I took a break to go to the backyard to see if the clothes on the line were dry,
and he walked out of the woods. When he helped me move the tree, well, he moved it all by himself. I said, thank you, of course. I don't know if you know this, but if you say thank you to one of them, you're obligated. I don't know why, that's just good manners.
Claudine had mentioned that in passing when I'd first met her, but I believed she told me it was simply a fairy etiquette thing. Mindful of my manners, I'd tried to be sure to never explicitly thank Niall, even when we'd swapped gifts at Christmas. It had taken every bit of self-control I'd had not to say thank you. I'd said, oh, you thought of me. I know I'll enjoy it, and clamped my lips together. But Claude, I'd been around him so often, I knew I'd thanked him for taking out the garbage or passing me the salt. Crap.
Anyway, I asked him if he wanted a drink, and he was thirsty, and I was so lonely, and I wanted a baby. Your grandpa and me had been married 5 years by then, and not a sign of a baby on the way. I figured something was wrong, though we didn't find out what until later when a doctor said the mumps had... Well, poor Mitchell. Was not his fault. It was the sickness. I just told him it was a miracle we'd had the two. We didn't need the 5 or 6 he'd hoped for. He never even looked at me funny about that. He was so sure I'd never been with someone else. It was coals of fire on my head. Bad enough, I did it once, but 2 years later, Fenton came back, and I did it again, and those weren't the only times. It was so strange. Sometimes I would think I smelled him. I would turn around, and it was Mitchell. But having your dad and Linda was worth the guilt. I loved them so much, and I hope it wasn't my sin that made them both die so young. At least Linda had Hadley, wherever she may be, and at least Corbett had you and Jason. Watching you grow up has been a blessing and a privilege. I love you both more than I can say. Well, I've been writing for a long time. I love you, honey. Now I have to tell you about your grandfather's friend. He was a dark-headed man, real big, talked real fancy. He said he was sort of like y'all's sponsor, like a sort of godfather, but I didn't trust him any farther than I could throw him. He didn't look like a man of God. He dropped by after Corbett and Linda were born. After you two came along, I thought maybe he might come around again. Sure enough, he showed up all of a sudden. Once while I was keeping Jason, and once while I was keeping you, when you were both in the cradle. He gave each of you a gift, he said. But if so, it wasn't one I could put in the bank account, which would have been useful when you came to live with me. Then he came by one more time a few years ago. He gave me this green thing. He said fairies give it to each other when they're in love, and Fenton had given it to him to bring here to me if Fenton died before I did. It's got a magical spell in it, he said. You won't ever need to use it, I hope, he said. But if you do, he said to remember that it was a one-time thing, not like a lamp, like in the story with a lot of wishes. He called this thing a Cluvial door and showed me how to spell it. So I guess Fenton is dead, though I was scared to ask the man any questions. I haven't seen Fenton since after your dad and Linda were born. He held them both, and then he left. He said he couldn't come again ever, that it was too dangerous for me and the kids,
that his enemies would follow him here if he kept visiting, even if he came in disguise. I think maybe he was saying he'd come in disguise before, and that worries me. And why would he have enemies? I guess the fairies don't always get along, just like people. To tell you the truth, I'd been feeling worse and worse about your grandpa every single time I saw Fenton. So when he said he was going for good, it was more or less a relief. I still feel plenty guilty. But when I remember raising your daddy and Linda, I'm so glad I had them. And raising you and Jason has been a joy to me. Anyway, this letter is yours now, since I'm leaving you the house and the Cluviel door. It may not seem fair that Jason didn't get anything magical, but your grandfather's friend said Fenton had watched both of you, and you were the one it should go to. I guess I hope you won't ever need to know any of this. I always wondered if your problem came from you being a little bit fairy, but then how come Jason wasn't the same? Or your dad and Linda, for that matter? Maybe you being able to know things just happened. I wish I could have cured it, so you could have had a normal life. But we have to take what God gives us, and you've been real strong handling it. Please be careful. I hope you're not mad at me, or think the worse of me. All God's children are sinners. At least my sinning led to life for you and Jason and Hadley. Adele Hale Stackhouse, Grandmother.
There was so much to think about that I didn't know where to start. I was simultaneously stunned, startled, curious, and confused. Before I could stop myself, I picked up my other relic, the worn velvet bag. I loosened the drawstring, which crumbled in my fingers. I opened the bag and let the hard thing inside, the Cluviel door, the gift from my fairy grandfather, fall into my palm. I loved it instantly. It was a creamy light green, trimmed in gold. It was like one of the snuff boxes at the antique store, but nothing in Splendide had been this beautiful. I could see no catch, no hinge, nothing. It didn't pop open when I gently pressed and twisted the lid, and there was definitely a lid, trimmed in gold. The round box wasn't ready to yield its secret. Okie dokie, maybe I had to do some research. I put the object to one side and sat with my hands folded on the table, staring into space. My head was crowded with thoughts. Gran had obviously been very emotional when she wrote the letter. If our godfather had given Gran more information about this gift, either she'd neglected to mention it or she simply hadn't remembered anything else. I wondered when she'd forced herself to set down this confession. Obviously, it had been written after Aunt Linda died, which had happened when Gran was in her 70s. My birth grandfather's friend? I was pretty sure I recognized the description. Surely the godfather was Mr. Cataliades, demon lawyer. I knew it must have cost her plenty to say, on paper, that she'd had sex with someone other than her husband. My grandmother had been a strong individual, and she'd also been a devout Christian. Such an admission must have haunted her. She might have judged herself. But now that I'd gotten over the shock of seeing my grandmother as a woman, I didn't judge her. Who was I to throw stones? The preacher had told me that all sins were equal in the eyes of God, but I couldn't help but feel, for example, that a child molester was worse than a person who cheated on his income tax or a lonely woman who'd had unsanctioned sex because she wanted a baby. I was probably wrong, because we also weren't supposed to pick and choose which rules we obeyed, but that was the way I felt. I shoved my confused thoughts back into a corner of my head and picked up the Cluvial door again. Touching its smoothness was pure pleasure, like the happiness I'd felt when I'd hugged my great-grandfather, but times about 200. The Cluvial door was about the size of 2 stacked Oreo cookies. I rubbed it against my cheek and felt like purring. Did you have to have a magic word to open it? Abracadabra, I said. Please and thank you? Nope, didn't work. Plus, I felt like an idiot. Open sesame, I whispered. Presto change-o. Nope. But thinking of magic gave me an idea. I emailed Amelia, and it was a difficult message to phrase. I know email isn't totally secure, but I also had no reason to think anyone considered my few messages of any importance. I wrote, I hate to ask, but besides doing that research on the blood bond for me, can you find out something about a fae thing? Initials C.D.? That was as subtle as I could get. Then I returned my admiration of the Cluvial door. Did you have to be pure fairy to open it? No, that couldn't be the case. It had been a gift to my grandmother, presumably to use in case of dire need, and she had been completely human. I wished it hadn't been far away in the attic when she'd been attacked. Whenever I remembered how she'd been discarded on the kitchen floor like offal, soaking in her own blood, I felt both sick and furious. Maybe if she'd had time to fetch the Cluvial door, she could have saved herself. And with that thought, I'd had enough. I returned the Cluvial door to its velvet bag, and I returned Gran's letter to the pattern envelope. I'd had as much upset as I could handle for a while. It was necessary to hide these items. Unfortunately, their previous excellent hideaway had been removed to a store in Shreveport. Maybe I should call Sam. He could put the letter and the Cluvial door in the safe at Merlot's, but considering the attacks on the bar, that wouldn't be the best place to stow something I valued. I could drive over to Shreveport and use my key to enter Eric's house to find someplace there. In fact, it was highly possible that Eric had a safe too, and had never had occasion to show it to me. After I'd mulled it over, that didn't seem like a good idea either. I wondered if my desire to keep the items here was simply because I didn't want to be parted from the Cluvial door. I shrugged. No matter how the conviction had come into my head, I was sure the house was the safest place, at least for now. Perhaps I could put the smooth green box into the sleeping hole for vampires in my guest bedroom closet, but that wasn't much more than a bare box, and what if Eric needed to spend the day there? After racking my brain, I put the pattern envelope into the box of unexamined paper items from the attic. These would be uninteresting to anyone but me. The Cluvial door was a little more difficult to stow away, at least partly because I kept having to resist an impulse to pull it out of the bag again. That struggle made me feel very Gollum-esque.
My precious,
I muttered. Would Dermot and Claude be able to sense the nearness of such a remarkable item? No, of course not. It had been in the attic all the time and they hadn't found it. What if they'd come to live here in hopes of finding it? What if they knew or suspected I had such a thing? Or, more likely, what if they were staying here because they were made happy by its proximity? Though I was sure there were holes in that idea, I couldn't shake it. It wasn't my fairy blood that drew them. It was the presence of the Cluvial door. Now you're just being paranoid, I told myself sternly, and I risked one more glimpse of the creamy green surface. The Cluvial door, I thought, looked like a miniature powder compact. With that idea, the right hiding place came to me. I took the Cluvial door out of its velvet pouch and slid it into the makeup drawer of my dressing table. I opened my box of loose powder and sprinkled just a little over the gleam of creamy green. I added a hair from my brush. Ha! I was pleased with the result. As an afterthought, I stuffed the disintegrating velvet bag into my hose and belt drawer. My reason told me the ratty object was just a decaying old bag, but my emotions told me it was something important because my grandmother and my grandfather had touched it. I had so many thoughts ricocheting in my brain that it shut down for the day. After I'd done a little bit of housework, I watched the College Softball World Series on ESPN. I love softball because I played in high school. I loved seeing the strong young women from all over America. I loved watching them play a game as hard as they could, full tilt, nothing held in reserve. I realized while I was watching that I knew two other young women like that, Sandra Pelt and Janelyn Hopper. There was a lesson there, but I wasn't sure what it was. Chapter 7. I heard my two housemates come in Sunday night, not too late. Hooligans wasn't open on Sunday, and I tried not to wonder what they'd been doing all day. They were still asleep when I made my coffee on Monday morning. I moved around the house as quietly as I could, getting dressed and checking my email. Amelia was on her way, she said, and she added cryptically that she had something important to tell me. I wondered if she had found out information about my CD already. Tara had sent out a group email with an attached picture of her huge belly, and I reminded myself that the baby shower I was giving her was the next weekend. Yikes! After a moment of panic, I calmed myself. The invitations were sent, I'd bought her gift, and I'd planned the food. I was as ready as I could be, aside from the last-minute flurry of cleaning. I was working the early shift today. As I put on my makeup, I took out the Cluvial door and held it to my chest. Touching it seemed important, seemed to make it more vital. My skin warmed it quickly. Whatever lay at the heart of that smooth, pale greenness seemed to quicken. I felt more alive, too. I took a deep, shaky breath and returned it to the drawer, again dusting it with powder to make it look like it had been there forever. I shut the drawer with something like regret. My grandmother felt very close to me that day. I thought about her on the drive to work, during my prep work, and in odd moments as I fetched and carried. Andy Belfleur was eating lunch with Sheriff Dearborn. I was a little surprised Andy wanted to sit down in Merlot's again after the invasion of 2 days before. But my new favorite detective seemed happy enough to be there, joking with his boss and eating a salad with low-fat dressing. Andy was looking slimmer and younger these days. Married life and impending fatherhood agreed with him. I asked him how Hallie was doing.
She says her stomach's huge, but it's not, he said with a smile. I think she's glad school's out. She's making curtains for the baby's room.
Hallie taught at the elementary school. Miss Caroline would be so proud, I said. Andy's grandmother, Caroline Belfleur, had died just weeks before.
I'm glad she knew before she passed, he said. Hey, did you know my sister's pregnant too?
I tried not to look too astonished. Andy and Portia had had a double wedding in their grandmother's garden, and though it hadn't been a surprise to hear that Andy's wife was pregnant, somehow the older Portia had never struck me as someone who'd welcome motherhood. I told Andy how glad I was, and that was the truth.
Would you tell Bill? Andy asked, a little shyly. I still feel a little weird about calling him.
My neighbor and former flame, Bill Compton, who happened to be a vampire, had finally told the Belfleurs that he was their ancestor right before Miss Caroline died. Miss Caroline had reacted beautifully to the startling news, but it had been a little harder for Andy, who was both proud and not too fond of the undead. Portia had actually gone out with Bill a few times before he'd figured out the relationship. Awkward, huh? She and her husband had sucked up their reservations about their newly acquired living ancestor, and they'd surprised me with their dignity in acknowledging Bill.
I'm always glad to pass along good news, but he'd be glad to hear from you.
I hear he's got a vampire girlfriend.
I made myself look cheerful.
Yeah, she's been there for a few weeks, I said. I haven't talked to him much about it.
Like, not ever. You've met her?
Yeah, she seems nice.
In fact, I'd been responsible for their reunion, but that wasn't something I wanted to share.
If I see him, I'll tell him for you, Andy. I know he'll want to know when the baby's born. Do you know what you and Hallie are having?
It's a girl,
he said, and his smile almost split his face in two.
We're going to name her Caroline Compton Belfleur.
Oh, Andy, that's so nice. I was ridiculously pleased because I knew Bill would be. Andy looked embarrassed. I could tell he was relieved when his cell phone chirped.
Hey, honey,
he said, having glanced at the caller number before he flipped his phone open.
What's up?
He smiled as he listened.
Okay, I'll bring you a milkshake, he said. See you in a few.
Bud was coming back to the table, and Andy glanced at the check and slapped a 10 down.
There's my part, he said. Keep the change. Bud, I gotta go run by the house. Hallie needs me to put up the curtain rod in the baby's room, and she's dying for a butterscotch milkshake. I won't be but 10 minutes.
He grinned at us and was out the door. Bud resumed his seat while he slowly got his own money out of his worn old wallet.
Hallie's having one. Porsche's having one. Tara's having two, I hear. Sookie, you need to get you one of those little ones,
he said, and took a drink.
Good iced tea.
He set his empty glass down with a little thump. I don't need to have a baby just because other women are doing it, I said. I'll have one when I'm ready.
Well, you ain't having one at all if you keep dating that deader,
Bud said bluntly.
What do you think your gran would say?
I took the money, turned on my heel, and walked away. I asked Danielle if she'd take Bud his change. I didn't want to talk to Bud anymore. Stupid, I know. I had to be thicker skinned than that, and Bud had only spoken the truth. Of course, he had the perspective that all young women wanted to have children, and he was pointing out to me that I was on the wrong track, as if I didn't know that. What would Gran have said? I would have answered without a pause a few days ago. Now I wasn't so sure. There'd been so much I hadn't known about her. But my best guess was that she would have told me to go with my heart. And I loved Eric. As I picked up a burger basket and took it to Maxine Fortenberry's table, she was having lunch with Elmer Claire Vaudrey, I found myself anticipating the moment of dark when he would wake. I looked forward to seeing him with a kind of desperation. I needed the reassurance of his presence, the assurance that he loved me, too, the passionate connection we felt when we touched each other. As I waited for an order at the hatch, I watched Sam pull a draft. I wondered if he felt the same way about Janilyn as I felt about Eric. He dated her longer than he dated anyone since I'd known him. Maybe I figured he was more serious because he was arranging for nights off so he could see her more often, something he'd never done before. Sam smiled at me when his eyes caught mine. It was sure nice to see him happy. Though Janilyn was not good enough for him. I almost clapped a hand over my mouth. I felt as guilty as though I'd said that out loud. Their relationship wasn't any of my business, I told myself sternly. But a softer voice inside me said that Sam was my friend and that Janilyn was too ruthless and violent to make him happy in the long run. Janilyn had killed people, but I had too. Maybe I judged her as violent because she sometimes seemed to enjoy the killing. The idea that I might be like Janilyn at heart, how many people did I want dead, was another downer. Surely the day had to get better. Pretty much always a fatal thought. Sandra Pelt strode into the bar. It had been a long time since I'd seen her, and she'd been trying to kill me then, too. She'd been a teenager then, and she still had yet to turn 20, I figured. But she looked a little older, her body more mature, and she had a cute shag hairdo that contrasted oddly with the snarl on her face.